This is the game of basketball. You've got to find the hot hand. If you're out on a basketball court and somebody has a hot hand and you decide not to get them the ball, it's a fight that takes place. What is the matter with you? It's understood in the game of basketball. If you have the hot hand, you go to the hot hand. If you go away from the hot hand, there's going to be a problem.
Whether you're on a playground or deep in the playoffs, one thing is obvious. The court is ruled not by an iron fist, but by the hot hand. You feed the hot hand. You stoke the hot hand. You aim to warm yourself by its flames. So today, as the conference finals are now in full swing, a scientific heat check into whether that burning sensation is a verifiable reality, or just a puff of smoke. I'm Pablo Torre. It's Wednesday, June 23rd. This is ESPN Daily. Ben Cohen, we go back, way back actually, to being young 20-something journalists in New York City, but I want to start out here by you explaining to our audience where it is that you work and what it is that you do.
I work for the Wall Street Journal, where I cover sports and I mostly report about the NBA.
So you report on the NBA for the Journal, and you're also an author, Ben. And it's the book that you've written that makes me want to talk to you today, because that book is titled The Hot Hand. And it's a book that I have been thinking about a lot lately, especially in a week like this, just days after a guy named Kevin Huerter apparently became the greatest shooter of all time and ruined my life, because the book is all about performances like Kevin Huerter's, like Terrence Mann's, a couple days before that, the idea of basketball players just catching fire. And you dig into what has been this pretty surprisingly contentious debate for decades now about whether that very concept is a real phenomenon that basketball people always assume it to be, or whether it's just a sports myth. So let's start here with you defining the term. What to you is the hot hand?
That is a great question, and I actually do not have a great answer to it, which seems like a great way to start this conversation. There is no singular definition of the hot hand, but generally it's the idea of success leading to more success. That's kind of the simplest way to think about it. So in basketball, and for the last three decades, it's been studied primarily through basketball. It's when you make one shot and then another shot and then another shot, and you feel more likely to make your next
Williams
shot.
Hangs, fires, yep. Scores again. He has a hot, hot hand.
You can't miss. You are in the zone. You are on fire.
Ducks in, gets the basket. We'll go to the free throw line.
Well, you ride the hot hand. We've seen deep breaks.
You are basically everything that your guy, Ben Simmons, is not.
Okay, so this hurts. This hurts in a couple of different ways. It hurts because you're absolutely correct. And it hurt because this is a thing that I have been conflicted about, because I try to impose my rational brain over the imperfect meat sack that is my body. And part of me is like, remember that time, though, when I played beer pong and I hit like five cups in a row and I felt like Michael Jordan giving the shrug after making six threes in the first half of the 92 NBA Finals? Like, I do want to understand exactly why it is that you wrote a book about this phenomenon in the first place.
Well, in part because this wonderful basketball phenomenon is not really about basketball. This is really about human behavior and how we make judgments and decisions. And I think we are all familiar with this sensation of the hot hand, whether it's through watching basketball or playing beer pong or, you know, any of those times in our lives when we are on a roll and there are profound consequences if we take advantage. But really, the reason to write a book about this is that because for the last 35 years, some of the smartest people on the planet have been engaged in this fascinating debate about whether or not the hot hand actually exists. This all started in 1985 with the publication of a classic paper in the Canon of Behavioral Economics. And what made it so classic was the highly counterintuitive conclusion that there is no such thing as the hot hand. It is simply a matter of seeing patterns in randomness and inventing causes to explain those stories. So, you know, I should mention that this was such an unbelievable finding at the time that many people, especially people in basketball, just refused to believe it. And that was the beginning of this incredible saga of Nobel Prize winners and NBA superstars trying to figure out the truth about this super intuitive phenomenon.
So maybe I am, in fact, the Michael Jordan of beer pong, is what you're telling me.
Do you know what's so funny, Pablo, is that for this book, I actually went to the World Series of beer pong and wanted to talk to all of these people. I found out what it is like to, you know, sort of lose control of your brain as you get progressively deeper into a tournament. And I left it all on the cutting room floor. So that is a deleted scene of the book that is exclusive to ESPN Daily right now.
I've never felt more kin to people who are better as they get less sober. Because, Ben, I mean, let's just be real. Here, though, like the idea of, you know what, I'm feeling it right now. I'm four beers in, I'm hitting every cup, I'm hitting every shot. It reminds me of, I think, a scene that is worth you painting for us here, because it's February 27th, 2013. The New York Knicks are hosting the Golden State Warriors, and there was a young player, maybe you've heard of him, not quite transcendent yet, named Steph Curry. And what happened?
Well, what happened is that Steph Curry came into Madison Square Garden and had the single greatest game of his life. It was a game that would change his career. It would change the fate of the Golden State Warriors. It would change the future of the NBA and basketball around the world. Steph Curry got hot.
Curry shoots a right wing three and buries it. And Golden State back in front.
He scored 54 points, which until very recently was the most points he had ever scored in a single game.
Curry, a right wing three, got it. 41 points from Steph Curry.
He made 11 of his 13 three-pointers. In the history of the NBA, no one had ever taken that many threes and made as many of them.
Straight away, Curry for the three, hits again.
He was a flame.
Pull up right wing three, got it. And Golden State back in front, 49 for Curry.
I mean, he was like a blazing fireball strutting across the court of Madison Square Garden.
Curry with a two-on-two, pull up three, yes!
If you were to ask Steph Curry, is there any way to predict when you are going to have the hot hand, when you are going to be in the zone? He would tell you no. There's no way to know when it's going to happen or where or how or why it's going to happen. The most important thing you can do is take advantage of it when it does happen.
When I'm knocking down transition threes, running full speed and able to stop on the dime and knock down that pull-up three, I know it's going to be a good night.
So it sounds like the hot hand, even though there might be some dispute, I mean, among NBA players, Ben, it reminds me of that famous Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart, who described pornography by saying, "I know it when I see it." In this case, they know it when they feel it. And you talk to Steph about that night at the Garden in particular. Did he have any ambiguity about whether he was embodying the title of your book?
No, of course not. I mean, he says it's the most locked in he has ever been. And in fact, if you ask him if he's ever met someone who does not believe in the hot hand, he says no, he has not met that person. And I think that is one of the really interesting things about the hot hand, because NBA players don't just believe in the hot hand. They behave as if they believe in the hot hand. The hot hand warps the behavior of everybody on the court and in an NBA arena, right? So when Steph gets hot, his teammates try to get him the ball. Steve Kerr calls plays to get him the ball. He has license to shoot from anywhere on the court, right? But the other team also behaves as if he is going to make his next shot. So they send double teams and triple teams. And we've all seen those photos of like five guys on the court focused on Steph Curry when he is crossing half court. The other coach tries to call a timeout. The other fans are trying to cool him off in some way. I mean, it takes something really extraordinary to alter behavior in a billion-dollar industry that is the NBA, and the hot hand is very clearly one of those phenomena.
And even linguistically, the terms you just mentioned there, right? Try to cool someone down, the idea of a heat check, Ben, the idea that somewhere on the spectrum of any given game, you could feel like a Steph Curry and also like a J.R. Smith. It all reminds me of a video game that I grew up that was as formative in my childhood as any cultural totem has ever been. And it's a game that you wrote about extensively in this book. It's the game that Steph himself played growing up, NBA Jam. How did the hot hand function in arguably the greatest video game that has ever been?
So before we talk about NBA Jam, we should talk about the guy who created NBA Jam. It was a guy named Mark Turmel. And when Mark Turmel was a kid, he loved three things. He loved video games, and he loved basketball, and what he really loved was fire. Mark Turmel was a childhood pyromaniac, and he would eventually combine all three of his childhood loves into the single biggest hit of his career.
Welcome to NBA Jam!
So when you play NBA Jam, if you make two or three shots in a row, you are heating up.
He's heating up!
And then you are on fire.
He's on fire!
The ball literally turns into a human fireball. And it is my belief that Mark Turmel single-handedly brainwashed an entire generation of impressionable young minds, me, you, Steph Curry, into believing that the hot hand was real. When you make three shots in a row, you are almost guaranteed to make your fourth.
Boom, shakalaka!
Oh, the animation changes, Ben, like the color scheme tints differently. It's that feeling made into a video game. And despite all of that being so, despite every basketball player knowing it's real, despite that childhood arsonist making it part of our lexicon and our culture, every fan, I think, feeling that, explain to me how it is that there has been such enormous dispute over the truth and reality of the concept.
Well, it started with that paper in 1985 that found there is no such thing as the hot hand. And this paper set about trying to investigate the hot hand in a bunch of different ways. They polled undergraduates at Cornell and Stanford about the hot hand, which is sort of the equivalent of Steph Curry asking his teammates, do you think the hot hand is real? They run their own controlled shooting experiment, but easily the coolest part of their research was what they did with your Philadelphia 76ers. The Sixers had this advanced pioneering statistician at the time named Harvey Pollack, who was so ahead of his time that he was literally nicknamed Superstat. And he was the only person in the league at the time who bothered keeping track of the chronological order of shots. That is, for almost the entirety of basketball history before this guy named Superstat, a made shot was just a made shot. It was hard to differentiate between a layup in the first quarter and Trae Young shooting from the logo in the fourth quarter. But this guy was the first to keep track of play-by-play data, and that was a goldmine to these researchers. It was the data they needed to test for the hot hand. And this paper, for an academic paper that was published in a fairly obscure academic journal, caused something of a firestorm, even in the NBA. It even reached Red Auerbach. When this paper was published, some lucky reporter got to tell Red Auerbach himself that a bunch of academics had done this study and found in their research that there was no such thing as the hot hand. You were no more likely to make your next shot after making a few shots in a row as you were after missing a few shots in a row.
And I feel like when Red Auerbach hears that, Ben, like the natural response in my mind's eye is for him to take his cigar, his burning cigar, and literally just like put it out on someone's hand and just ask them how that feels. Like, how does an NBA GM like that, an all-time legend, react to a question like that?
No, that's basically what happened. Red Auerbach says, so some guy makes a study. I could care less. And I like to think of it the same way. He just, like, extinguishes his cigar on some guy's human flesh. He takes a big swig of whatever whiskey is in his glass, and he storms out of the room never to think about the heresy that there is no such thing as the hot hand ever again. But, you know, lots of people did, including some of the smartest people on the planet. And the publication of that paper in 1985 was really the launching point of this ferocious debate that has stretched from the corners of nerdy academic conferences to the inner sanctums of MBA teams and to Wall Street and to lots of other places in between.
Okay, so there is this incredible disagreement that is more than about just science, Ben. It feels like it's about culture. It feels like it's about manhood. It feels like it's about ego and psychology. And the lines are drawn here between nerds and jocks. And I certainly empathize with both of those columns. Anyone who's seen me would guess which one I empathize with more. And so I just want to understand, why is it that this divide feels like it's about more than just basketball?
I think it reflects how much we should trust what we see with our own eyes and feel with our own emotions. And the reason why so many of us believed so fervently in the hot hand was that we had all felt it and we had seen it for ourselves. And here were these brilliant people coming along and telling us that no, we were actually wrong. No matter how much we believed in the hot hand, that didn't make it any more real. And I think people don't like to be told that something they could swear to be true is not actually true. And that set up this tension, this fight over the understanding of a single fundamental idea, something that was so universal that all of us had some experience with the hot hand in our lives. It wasn't like they were telling us some obscure part about the NBA or our own work lives was not quite what we believed. There is something like elemental in the hot hand. And I think it was so counterintuitive and so contrary to human belief and reason that it was only natural that it would drive people absolutely bananas.
All right, Ben, after the break, the hot hand makes a comeback.
Now let's talk about the play of the week. The pressure to follow up Hypnotic and Cognac weighing heavy on the team. Hypnotic was in the cup, blue, and ready for the play. And boom, Añejo Tequila came in with the smooth assist to Hypnotic's tropical fruit finish. Shaken, strained, poured, it was green and good. The playmaking splash shifted the tempo. Another great cocktail from the Hypnotic team. Every season is Hypnotic and tequila season. Hypnotic Liqueur, Bardstown, Kentucky. 17% alcohol by volume. Hypnotic reminds you to think wisely, drink wisely.
So, Ben, you've just told us about this paper from 1985 that argued that the hot hand simply does not exist, which naturally created this enormous flame war, so to speak, between the jocks and the nerds. And that is the sort of argument that gets rekindled pretty much anytime you watch an incredibly streaky shooter like evil Steph Curry himself, Trae Young. So when does the debate, the scientific debate here, when does that begin to thaw?
It only happens in the last decade or so. Now, ever since the publication of that 1985 paper, there were lots of people who came along and tried to prove that the hot hand was real. And no one could ever really do it with any definitive evidence or any degree of certainty. That changed in the last 5 years with two breakthrough papers that used data that was not available in 1985. This was data that was based on the high-resolution tracking cameras that are now in every NBA arena. And there were lots of ways to use the data that came from those cameras. So the first six teams that had SportView, as it was called, in their arenas were the Dallas Mavericks, the Oklahoma City Thunder, the San Antonio Spurs, Golden State Warriors, the Boston Celtics, and the Houston Rockets. In the decade that followed the installation of those cameras, those six teams happened to be the six winningest teams in the entire NBA. So clearly they were onto something. When the Mavericks won the 2011 title in one of their first seasons using SportView, it was very obvious that SportView was here to stay.
The Mavericks have scaled the NBA playoff mountain and have planted their flag. They are the NBA champions for 2010-2011.
But the business behind those tracking cameras based on Israeli technology, that it became this myth that it was Israeli missile tracking technology. In fact,
is it not the case? Because that's how I've been seeing it this entire time.
It's actually not the case. The people behind the technology, they did not go out of their way to correct the record because Israeli missile tracking technology offers a nice...
Sounds sophisticated.
It sounds amazing. But the real reason they did not correct the record was because they say tracking a missile is much easier than tracking the action on an NBA court. The missile goes up and down. You know what's going to happen. The NBA, you have 10 people in this dynamic, balletic fashion where nobody knows what's going to happen next or where Steph Curry or Trae Young are going to shoot from. It's easier to track a missile. So why should they correct the record? So what happens in the 2012 lockout is that they have no more clients. The business of basketball has stopped. And even though there are a bunch of teams that are interested in adding SportView cameras to their arenas, they couldn't find any clients. So they needed to find ways to show the value and utility of their product. They needed people who could take their data and investigate really fascinating, intriguing questions that would apply to the NBA. And those people came along. They were mostly academics and professors who looked at this gold mine of data and said, I want to get my hands on this because you could answer some really interesting questions using this information that nobody has ever had before.
Wait a sec, Ben. So the questions they decide to ask and probe with the aid here of, and I want to be clear about this now, what is, according to its makers, better than Israeli missile technology. What do they end up finding?
For the entire history of basketball, the hot hand had been masked. Because if you think about what happens when someone is hot, they take more difficult shots. They take longer shots, crazier shots, riskier shots, shots that would ordinarily earn them a permanent spot at the end of the bench. But they had license. They had permission to take these shots because they were hot. But not until very, very recently were you able to control for the difficulty of a shot. That is where the SportView data comes in. It allows you to figure out the exact probability of a shot going in. And when these college-aged researchers used this novel data set to answer a long question that had fascinated people for a very long time before them, it told them a slightly different answer. It told them that there actually was a small, slight, conservative hot hand effect. So not quite the fireball of our imagination from NBA Jam, but also not nothing. And not nothing was something and sort of close to everything about this, because it said that for the first time, we had some scientific evidence that our minds were not playing tricks on us. And all of us who believed in the hot hand did not need to check into the nearest asylum.
So ultimately, it is these college kids, Ben, who find that the oven in this metaphor is actually simmering slightly. There is heat. You can put your hand on it. You feel it. They notice something in that data. How has research since then built on all of these findings?
Well, what happened next was the publication of yet another paper about the hot hand, probably the most important one since that first one. And it was by a couple of young American economists in Europe. And what they found was a subtle mathematical bias in the way that we think about the hot hand that everybody who had looked at this problem had missed for 35 years. And once you take into account this subtle, kind of trippy statistical bias that is very hard to understand without looking at a whole bunch of charts and appendices of naughty economic theory papers. It turns out that there is such a thing as the hot hand, and there had been all along.
But hold on. So wait, the jocks then, I presume, are saying, hold, and this is not a thing a jock would say, but hold on. These nerds have been hoisted on their own appendices. It sounds like this is something that they were, wait, just wrong about. Like the locker stuffing, Ben, based on what you're telling me, that was a justified reaction. Where, what is, like, how significant is the hot end effect given that understanding now?
Well, it depends who you ask, right? I mean, if you ask some researchers, they will say it is somewhat significant. If you ask the people who wrote this paper in 2015, this was that subtle mathematical bias paper, they would say it is quite significant, you know? And we're talking here significant, not in terms of like mathematics or probability or statistical significance, but like real world application significant, which is really what we're talking about when we think about the hot hand. Like, how does this apply to these games that we are watching every night? And so that is part of the fun of this debate now, too, is not just do you believe in the hot hand? Do you think the hot hand is real? But to what degree do you believe in the hot hand, right? And like, when might it be real? And when is it still playing tricks on us?
So, Ben, after all of this accumulated research and wisdom, my first instinct is to just demand that you help save and fix Ben Simmons and the Philadelphia 76ers. But I presume you may have other angles on this game that have developed since you wrote this book.
I will hit the broader takeaways first, and then we can get to Ben Simmons afterwards. Does the last 5 years of research mean that everyone who insisted very loudly that the hot hand was definitely real was right all along? Maybe, but maybe not. Like, I do think there is something wonderful and super admirable about that original paper, because to me, the underlying principle is right. We do see patterns where they don't exist. We do exaggerate streakiness. Our minds do play tricks on us, and there are massive costs and all sorts of strange consequences from that bias. However, if you see Steph Curry, or if you see Trae Young, or if you see Kevin Huerter going supernova on a basketball court and you think the hot hand is real, well, you might not be wrong. And to me, the greater takeaway of that lesson is that sometimes the experts and the pros can be right. Like, sometimes our intuition can lead us astray, but other times it can be accurate. And I think this all signifies the importance of keeping an open mind. Like, even when we think we have a problem figured out, there's always new data and new ways of analyzing that data that come along and make us change our minds and question our long-held assumptions. Science and data and psychology and economics and statistics are capable of some truly mind-blowing things. But I don't know if they can explain Ben Simmons passing up an open dunk or struggling to shoot a free throw.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what I was worried about. Ben Cohen, as of this week, moving fast up my personal Ben Power rankings, I thank you for catching fire on ESPN Daily.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, up next, we go deep inside the surprisingly lucrative world of incredibly weird niche sports.
When you're on a business trip, you know what completely goes off the rails? Your workout routine, especially when you book a hotel that doesn't have a gym. So what ends up happening is you do a few push-ups and sit-ups in your room, run around the block, or just skip it entirely. Lame. If you just stay at La Quinta by Wyndham, you'll discover there's a fully equipped fitness center at every location. Now you can wake up and power your buys and tries the right way or de-stress with some cardio. The choice is yours. Tonight, La Quinta. Tomorrow, you shine. Book direct at LQ.com.
Here's another story I want you to know. So, I don't have a ton of free time these days, but every single weekend, what my friend Will and I do is meet up in the park and attempt to throw this frisbee-like thing called an Aerobee as far as we possibly can. And you've probably seen one of these things before. It's that plastic ring that's always brightly colored and that's always coming pretty close to just nailing some random child in the face. But my Aerobee addiction is my workout. It's my bizarro pickup basketball at this point. And this week, after reading about a guy named Paul Macbeth, I realized that it also may be my retirement plan. Because Paul Macbeth, it turns out, plays pro disc golf, which is a sport I didn't even know existed. He's won the PDGA World Championship 5 times now. But his true genius, according to a Ringer feature by David Gardner, isn't actually in his skill. It's in Macbeth's online influence, his 171,000 Instagram followers, and his role as the de facto king of the disc golf internet. Because Paul Macbeth has just extended his endorsement deal with Discraft, his preferred brand of golf disc, that guarantees him $10 million over the next 10 years. Yes, $10 million for disc golf, a non-televised game whose tournaments top out at $25,000, apparently, for the winner. And those 8 figures now put Paul Macbeth on par with star athletes you've actually heard of, like Justin Verlander and Khalil Mack, and the 70 or so pro athletes in the world in total, who make at least $1 million a year from endorsements. And yeah, $10 million for disc golf. That endorsement sounds insane, but in today's niche-driven influencer economy, it also adds up. Because you may now realize that your TikTok For You page, for instance, is tailor-made for your personal habits and your viewing history, and not anyone else's, much to my personal dismay. And that same algorithm is why a disc golf superfan would see viral Paul Macbeth videos on his screens more often than they do, like, Kevin Durant highlights. Which, I mean, let's be honest about this. This is staggering, terrifying technology. This is engineered to keep stuffing people with content from increasingly disparate troughs, effectively trapping all of us in our respective weirdo frisbee chambers. Each of which is now a real reminder that maybe one day I can soar as far and as high as my Aerobee can take me. I'm Pablo Torre, and this has been ESPN Daily. I'll talk to you tomorrow.